Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a high court justice sides with District Attorney Rachel Rollins in her fight against a Boston municipal court judge.
What I'm saying to you here is we have a really good opinion now, telling us something we knew since 1806.
Also today, MIT's fundraising is under new scrutiny after the weekend resignation of its Media Lab director.
I mean, everyone wanted a part of what the Media Lab was selling, and the salient point is that they were selling it.
And the Patriots kick off the NFL season with a big win.
Wide, wide open. Philip Dorsett. Big night for him. Touchdown.
We'll talk about the team and whether owner Robert Kraft's charge of soliciting prostitution should have kept him from the festivities.
We're prioritizing the Super Bowl trophies over the well-being of vulnerable people in our communities.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Now it is crystal clear that we have the authority to do what it is that we did. We will continue to do so, and there will be no indication whatsoever in this man's life that this ever occurred, because it never should have.
That's Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, speaking just a little while ago after a justice of the state's highest court ruled in her favor. Her office had asked the High Court to overrule Boston Municipal Court Judge Richard Sinnott over one of his decisions last week. When prosecutors tried to drop cases against some people arrested while protesting the so-called Straight Pride Parade, Judge Sinnott refused to do so. In a ruling today, Supreme Judicial Court Justice Frank Gaziano sided with Rollins, writing, quote, "The prosecutor's sole authority to determine which cases to prosecute and when not to pursue a prosecution has been affirmed repeatedly by this court since the beginning of the 19th century," end quote. We've reached out to Judge Sinnott. He's declined to comment. But joining us on the line now is Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. D.A. Rollins, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. I was just here, a couple hours ago?
Yeah, we've got to do it again because we've got news since the last time
we
talked.
We did, yeah.
That's right. So the news is that the SJC ruled in your favor. You had this emergency petition to instruct the lower court to uphold your decision not to prosecute one of the protesters from last month's Straight Pride Parade. How do you feel about this victory?
It feels good, obviously, to be affirmed, but for people who practice in criminal court, this is not a surprise. As said by Justice Gaziano, this is what prosecutors do every single day, is to decide, use our discretion, right? We're elected to do so. And, we've been doing it since the beginning of the 19th century. And the case he cited was from 1806. So that's the case we cited in our brief. And we're happy that, now it is incredibly crystal clear to everyone that we have the power to do this, and we're going to continue to do so.
So you say it's crystal clear. Does this then cover the other cases that you wanted dismissed from the arrest from the protesters of the Straight Pride Parade?
So what we're going to do is we're going to go back and look at every single sort of encounter that happened with this judge and others. There was at least one other judge involved in some of the 36 individuals. And so we're going to look at, did we ask for a null pros and it was denied, or did we ask the judge to dismiss the case on, let's say, hypothetically, 8 hours of community service? The judge said no, and then we asked for a null pros and it was denied. Or whether, you know, what each of the circumstances are. There are different buckets, and we're going to make sure that everything is consistent with our authority to determine who we want to prosecute and who we don't. So there might be a couple other cases that fall into this as well.
And for our listeners' understanding, a null pros stands for nolo prosequi, right? Which is basically, we do not want to prosecute this. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Right. And just remember, what was proposed here is, you know, essentially a judge abusing their limited discretion. A judge is like a referee in the courtroom. And so null processes are, we enter them. We don't even file them. We enter them. There's not, the wording sounds awkward because the judge doesn't even get to admit or deny or grant or deny what we're doing. It's our exclusive power to determine who we want to prosecute or not and how we want to allocate our limited resources. So I think the brief was incredibly well written. I want to make sure I give, appropriate thanks to my general counsel, Donna Padalano, and I think the supervisor of the Central Division of the Boston Municipal Court, Jessica Erickson. They, both of them were with me at the press conference, did an exceptional job. She was unflappable, made a really great record, making it clear why we were taking the position that we were. And then what the judge had tried to do was argue that he was denying it because we failed to notify victims. And Justice Gaziano just eviscerated that argument, right? Number one, disorderly conduct, it's an offense against the public. There is no victim. And then he went so far as to say, and even if there was a victim of an offense who the prosecutor hadn't notified, the judge had no authority to deny the Commonwealth's entry of a null pros. So this is crystal clear, this judge, and, you know, I would go so far as to, he's worked in the Suffolk County DA's office before, It's a complete abuse of discretion. We're happy that Justice Gaziano very quickly determined that. Now we can get back to doing the important work of what we're doing.
So you just referred to it as a complete abuse of discretion, and it seems it's hard not to read the finding as a rebuke of Judge Sinnott. Will there be consequences for him as a result of this finding?
Well, I think that's interesting. It's, I made it clear I don't have any intention of filing any, you know, complaints against Judge Sinnott. When I have a disagreement or this office has a disagreement with either the government or an actor, I believe the appropriate forum is the court. And so when we challenged ICE's behavior, DA Ryan and myself and some others filed a preliminary injunction and a request for declaratory relief in federal district court, and that was granted. We're very excited. We're waiting for the determination on the declaratory judgment. Just like here, when this judge exceeded his limited authority, we filed an emergency petition. And we are really, you know, happy that Justice Gaziano, cited case law dating back to the 19th century saying, nope, you can't do that. We are aware, I mean, I read the newspaper, I'm aware that some complaints have been filed against him, but I'm not going to be involved in those at all.
So, you know, there's been speculation from the beginning of this that the judge was essentially pushing back on your larger reform agenda rather than just on these sort of discrete decisions you were making in the courtroom that day. So given this finding, is this a vindication of your general approach to reform in the criminal justice system?
Well, what's really interesting is not that I need the validation of the people that came before me, but I find it really funny that no one questioned prosecutorial discretion when, A, it benefits them, right, number one, and number two, when it was moving toward, you know, significant wealth and race-based disparities, mass incarceration and all these other things across the country and in some of those instances in the Commonwealth as well. But now that we have people getting elected that have a different view of the system and how we're going to allocate our limited resources, now all of a sudden people are, you know, outraged that we're using discretion that my predecessors dating back to 1807, all the other 15 DAs before me used every single day. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think he, I can't speculate. I'm confident he does not agree with what I proposed as a candidate and what the people of Suffolk County voted me in twice to do. But I have a mandate, and I'm an elected official. He's appointed. I think it was particularly egregious because his one opinion does not trump what the people of Suffolk County have made it clear they want and deserve.
So, D.A. Rollins, there has been this wave of elections around the country of what one might call progressive prosecutors who are seeking reform. We had journalist and author Emily Bazelon on last week. I think you know her or have some past history with her.
I do.
She pointed to incidents in Florida and Pennsylvania and says that we're seeing similar reactions to what you experienced nationally.
We're seeing these arguments play out around the country. The voters pick a reform-minded prosecutor, and then the system tries to prevent that person from making change.
You know, you've referred in the past to being in touch with other recently elected progressive prosecutors. You know, are you guys sharing information about similar experiences across the country? Is there a general pushback to these reforms that we're seeing consistently?
Absolutely, yeah. And what they try to do is pit us against law enforcement or say that we, you know, don't care about law enforcement, but it couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, what I want to focus on is of these 36 arrests that got us here today, just talking, 8 of them immediately we arraigned because they were violent or serious crimes, more serious than the disturbing the peace or the trespassing or the other generically or generally nonviolent matters that people could either get a civil infraction for or do some community service, depending on what their criminal background is or, you know, a little bit more information that we might have. But we're seeing across the country that in Philadelphia, for example, with D.A. Krasner, the legislature is trying to take control exclusively in Philadelphia, not in Pennsylvania, across the state or the Commonwealth, but just in Larry's jurisdiction, they want to take away certain powers to prosecute gun crimes. We see in Florida with Aramis, who's my counterpart in a section of Florida, where she was talking about the death penalty and what her position was going to be there, we see a governor trying to take away the power of her, jurisdiction over death penalty cases. And what we've seen here is with me, you know, before I even took office, a National Police Association filing a complaint against my bar license, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association making blanket statements with no evidence or data supporting them, and then ironically the Boston Police coming out and showing that violent crime is down by 8% in the first 6 months of my tenure as compared to last year. And then Secretary Turco, Governor Baker, you know, all of these people that I think if you line them up and had photos of them and then a photo of me, I look very different than the people they're used to having in this position. And the people of Suffolk County are really excited about that because we don't have time for nonsense. We're moving for change. And I promised I would do it, and I always make true on my promises.
I want to invite you to respond to criticism of your choice to use sort of this reform approach in the case of the Straight Pride Parade. There has been some argument that by choosing not to prosecute in some of these cases, you may in fact be encouraging outside agitators or people who have a history of violence like Antifa members from outside to come in and cause trouble here in Boston. Here's Larry Calderone. You mentioned the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. He's the vice president, and he was positive about Judge Sinnott's decision in the first place.
So I can go back years of former DAs looking to dismiss disorderly charges, which I'm sure we'll be reminded of. And this DA's office is doing the same thing, but the judge on the bench has taken a different position. We like that position. We think that these offenders that are here came here as agitators, here for a specific reason, here to create havoc.
Now, obviously, the Supreme Judicial Court did not like the judge's decision, but is there any merit to the concern that if one doesn't prosecute in these cases, it may invite additional outside agitation in the future?
Well, but it's not about liking or disliking, right? Like, just even listen to the language that this person's using. It doesn't matter whether I like you or not. The First Amendment applies to you. Period, end of story, right? It doesn't matter whether Justice Gaziano likes Judge whomever or not, or likes me. It's not about that. It's about hundreds of years of precedent showing that we have the right to do this. So it's great that that individual representing the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association likes what this judge says. Okay, well, that's one judge. I'd ask them to see if they can have all their cases in front of that judge. But the people of Suffolk County, and by the way, many of the individuals that that person represents don't live in Suffolk County, voted overwhelmingly for a change. And I think it shows very clearly that they aren't happy with what the way things have been working for quite some time. And there are a lot of people that are invested in the system working exactly the way that it is, where people of limited means and overwhelmingly black and brown people are not winning, right? They're not getting a fair shake when they get before a judge that doesn't look like them, a prosecutor that doesn't look like them, a criminal defense attorney that doesn't look like them, a probation officer that doesn't look like them, and the police officer that arrested them might not look like them or speak their language or care, right? There's a lot of sentiment out there, and I'm excited about the fact that some of the dust-ups we've had have resulted in some really important conversations happening. And right before I started your interview, Commissioner Gross called me, and we're going to have a discussion about, I think, some of the things that I said in my press conference. But even if we don't agree, I respect him. I respect his position. I'm always going to take that call, and I'm going to, you know, listen to what it is he has to say, and I'm capable of adapting if necessary.
And that's Boston Police Commissioner William Gross you're referring to.
That is correct. And I also want you to know I did have a good conversation when I determined that we were going to appeal this with the president, actually, of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, not the vice president, the president, Leary, regarding what my statement was going to be, and paid him the courtesy of giving him a copy of that prior to it being released to the press. So there can be respect even when there's disagreement, and I believe that's where we are, whether it's ICE, whether it's the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. But remember what my role is. Like, when there's an officer-involved shooting, my job is to see whether or not it was a lawful, reasonable shoot or not. We aren't friends. I have to do my job to see whether things entered into a criminal realm or not. And so the fact that, you know, people are seeming to imply that either I report to them or they report to me or we can't do things without each other. Yes, we are inextricably tied, but we don't report to each other. We have a very good, respectful relationship, but sometimes we aren't going to agree.
We'd love to have the two of you back on to the show together sometime in the future to talk more about that relationship.
You bet. You bet.
All right. So that is Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Boston this afternoon.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Stay with us. Coming up, MIT's fundraising under new scrutiny after the weekend resignation of its Media Lab director. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. MIT will bring in an outside firm to investigate the connections between the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and the MIT Media Lab. Lab director Joey Ito resigned after a New Yorker article revealed how he had concealed his connection to the financier. Joining me now to catch up on this story is WBUR's Max Larkin. Max, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana.
So we knew that Jeffrey Epstein had ties to the MIT Media Lab and Joey Ito. We've known that for a while. What did we learn this weekend that pushed things over the edge, Max?
So, yeah, going back to the middle of August, you have Joey Ito publish an apology. He said he'd accepted money from Epstein, both for the Media Lab and into investment funds that he controlled, and that he'd visited several of Epstein's residences. He called it an error in judgment, Tiziana. And so he made this effort to appear really transparent and contrite, and that was kind of in keeping with the reputation of him being kind of a good guy in tech. But then the story shifts late Friday night. In a New Yorker article, you have Ronan Farrow drawing on internal emails to show that Ito and others had known about Epstein's reputation and the crimes that he'd allegedly committed, pleaded guilty to, and they'd continued to work with him, and that they tried to mask those ties by filing them as anonymous and making other changes and soliciting more money than we'd previously known. So that kind of put it over the top, I think.
Okay, so how did we learn about all this?
Yeah, Ronan Farrow clearly received a cache of emails from Signe Swenson, who'd worked with in development at the lab until 2016. Swenson said she resigned right around then in protest of the Epstein ties and the lab's efforts to mask them. So you have a number of people now at the Media Lab who say they knew about the ties, so they tried to warn Ito against forming a relationship with Epstein, and then he went ahead and formed that relationship anyway.
And then in some way covered up that relationship. So tell us more exactly about how Ito did that, or at least kept secret these donations from or arranged by Epstein.
Yeah, we really just have these emails. Pending this investigation, we really just have the emails that have appeared in The New Yorker. We have Ito and one other exec at the Media Lab talking about, well, this is Jeffrey money and we'll label it as anonymous. And then going forward, they allowed him to act as a conduit for money. He sent $2 million from Bill Gates, $5.5 million from Leon Black, who's a private equity titan. And in that case, Epstein's role as a conduit was masked as well.
Okay, so Ito resigned on Saturday. Did he say, listen, this is the result of the New Yorker piece? Is that what forced the resignation?
Not in anything that I've seen. He's been very circumspect in the emails that sources have sent me. He sent a brief note to fellows who happened to be on campus. He simply apologized once again, and he thanked them for, quote, allowing him to try to make amends.
Any other fallout at the Media Lab, other resignations, et cetera?
Yeah, one of the other people implicated in the emails is Peter Cohen. He had been the lab's director of development during the years in question. He had started a similar role at Brown University in late 2018. He was placed on leave today or over the weekend in response to his involvement in this story. Then you have MIT's president, Raphael Reif, announcing the external review that you mentioned in the opening. And then I think you have a lot of people who are kind of students and community members who think there's really a lot of healing now that has to go on. It's an increasingly diverse community, and I think you have a lot of people who are calling particularly for more women in leadership, women who might not have a big old blind spot about misogyny or sexual abuse. One of those people is Anand Giridharadas. He's a journalist who resigned from a prize committee at the Media Lab last week in light of the ties.
Frankly, I think a woman needs to just take over this Media Lab and just clean it up. It's amazing to me. There's so many women who run labs, who do science. Virtually all of these women are able to do that without becoming friends with Jeffrey Epstein.
It's a pretty powerful data point. The circle of scientists, researchers, academics around Epstein was largely male. Not entirely, but largely. And I think that's going to be a question on a lot of people's minds as they look for Ito's replacement.
Hmm. Okay, Max, last week over 200 people signed a letter in support of Joy Ito just a week ago, including some staff members of MIT. You spoke with some of them last week. Have you heard from any of them after Ito's resignation?
Yeah, and I think they are feeling all the awkwardness and pain of this situation. I think a lot of them feel that they went to bat for their friend, Joey Ito, without having full information of what was going on. And they hadn't heard the whole story, and they put their reputations on the line, and they feel they kind of got burned. But then you do have people like the local Harvard legal scholar, Lawrence Lessig, who's still going to bat for Joey Ito. He published a long letter on Medium, and he said, yes, this was a failure, both of me as a friend and of Joey as a human being, but there's a bigger system at play here that MIT could have stepped in, that other forces in the university and in Joey's orbit might have said, hey, you have to avoid this guy. And it was just a major oversight for a lot of pretty smart people.
Max, you reported for BUR last month that Epstein actually has even more connections to Harvard faculty than to MIT. Is there more fallout coming?
I think there may be, Tiziana. Harvard, in contrast, MIT, has kept relatively mum here. I think it's worth noting that Harvard took a lot of its on-the-books Epstein money back before he was first indicted and pleaded guilty, whereas MIT took the money afterward. But yeah, you have Alan Dershowitz joining his legal team during his first trial. You have Harvard psychologist Stephen Kosslyn apparently visiting him twice in jail. And then you have a host of Harvard faculty who forged personal social relationships with him. I think journalists naturally will turn their attention to Harvard this week.
And are we just looking at the nature of higher ed finance here overall with this scandal?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting part of this story, and hopefully we'll get a great conversation after I clear out. You do have this kind of keeping up with the Joneses element. There are now global rankings of universities. All of these institutions are competing with one another for dollars to expand, hire new researchers, et cetera. So there is a sense in which we're looking at something like a new paradigm, a scary new paradigm for some, of what higher ed financing looks like. I spoke to Derek Balk. He was a former president of Harvard, and he said those rankings kind of drive a chase for money that gets ever more intense.
When you get interested in the rankings, which have to do often a lot to do with research, I don't think any university is going to depend entirely on whatever the state can spare. If you can get private donations to make possible programs and researchers that promise to improve your stature in the world, you're going to do that.
Now, Tiziana, I just want to say, Balk was clear. He doesn't think fundraising is like an intrinsically icky business that leaves you feeling awful at the end of the day. He said, you know, back in 2006, in fact, he defended taking Jeffrey Epstein's money, saying, you know, that we are converting this into something really good. But he says he draws the line at taking money from autocratic regimes. Both Harvard and MIT took money from Saudi Arabia. Or he said he remembered saying no to a big donation to the School of Public Health from Philip Morris, the large cigarette manufacturer. So he said it's kind of this balancing act, but you don't want to sully the name of your institution as you're trying to, you know, make it ever more prestigious and its research more far-reaching.
That's WBUR's Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Okay, so we're going to add some voices for reaction to this story. From New York, we have Justin Peters. He's a Slate columnist and the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. Justin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
And here in Studio 3 is Phil Buchanan, president of the Center for Effective Philanthropy. He's also the author of Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. Phil, it's good to have you here.
Good to be here, Tiziana.
Okay, so Justin, I'm going to start with you. You weren't a student at MIT, but you lived in Boston and visited and wrote about the Media Lab for years. In your piece for Slate yesterday entitled The Moral Rot of the MIT Media Lab, you write about how you started off really awestruck with the place when you first visited, but that changed. Why? What turned you against the lab?
I guess I recognized the gap between the rhetoric and the reality of the place, the world-changing ambitions of the people who studied there and worked there and ran the research groups there, and the way that those ambitions inevitably ended up ending up as more commercial than they claimed.
What do you mean by that, Justin?
Well, like, for example, I wrote a thesis about the effective computing research group there, where they were going on and on about developing computers that could sense emotions that would be used for autistic people to help them make their way through the world and other neurodivergent sorts. And then a year later, they spun off that research into a private company that now makes a lot of money licensing that same emotion technology to market research firms and automotive companies and all other sorts of, you know, for-profit entities that seek to be able to read your emotions so that they can more effectively sell you goods and services. Now, is there anything sort of fundamentally immoral about that? I don't know that there is, but the sort of variance between what was claimed was going to change the world and then the way the technology eventually ends up changing the world, that seemed to play out over and over again. And, you know, I just sort of, the place lost its luster for me as someone who was writing about it and actually believed in it for a while.
Phil Buchanan, your book is about giving done right. You've just heard Justin's example there. Was giving done right here in this case, or were there flaws, moral or otherwise, in the MIT Media Lab's approach to fundraising?
Yeah, Tiziana, I think there are some basic questions any nonprofit or university fundraiser or leader should ask, and they include questions like, would we be embarrassed if it were widely known that we had this support? Is this an effort that is going to help the donor accomplish something that's counter to what we believe? Does the donor expect us to alter our mission in some way to provide them some benefit? Would our key constituents, including our students, faculty, alumni, be comfortable with this. And at least on the first and the last question, I think the answer is pretty clear here.
No, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This way, and we should have expectations for nonprofits and fundraisers and nonprofit leaders that even though this is still about raising money, the ideal is about the mission, that there's something bigger. This is separate from our, in a way, from our market economy, right? These are institutions that are supposed to put mission first. And if we can't count on an institution with $16 billion in its endowment to do that, who can we count on? So I think it's really a really depressing story, and I can only imagine what some of the women quoted in some of the media reports who were working at the Media Lab must have felt as they saw Jeffrey Epstein come in for meetings there.
Justin, you had harsh words both for Joy Ito and previous leaders of the lab. Ito has resigned. You seem to be talking about a much larger and more systemic problem at the MIT Media Lab. So was it appropriate for Ito to resign as one piece of that larger problem? Should he be taking the brunt of the blame for this relationship?
Well, certainly. He's the one who signed off on taking money from a convicted sexual offender whose crimes were turned out to be greater than anyone knew. But you did know at the time when you courted him for his money that he had been convicted in Florida for procuring an underage girl for prostitution. And you, being an incredibly well-connected person as Joy Ito is, certainly, if you did not know the rumors surrounding Jeffrey Epstein, that's just because you didn't want to hear them. So I think it's appropriate that he's gone. I also think it's notable that the Media Lab exists outside of MIT's endowment. It's always been self-funding, and at least for the past 15 years or so, that funding has come very sort of directly from corporations and industry and apparently people like Epstein, who are all attempting to derive some benefit from their association with the place. And that money does not come without strings attached. The Media Lab does make much of the fact that its sponsors do not get to set the research priorities for the groups in the lab. But the broader sort of nexus there, where industry and academic research are all pulling together to create outcomes that satisfy everyone, like, I feel like that is the sort of thing that eventually, inevitably leads to taking money from someone who is very toxic just because that money is offered and you think you can make something good out of it,
Justin,
because you've never been proven wrong before.
Let me bring Phil Buchanan in on this. Phil, just what are your reactions to Justin's comments?
Well, I agree with Justin, and I think that the larger institution also bears some responsibility here for setting policies and guidelines and establishing what are the basic, you know, values that guide our fundraising efforts. And I think it's also important to note that this is also a failure of the criminal justice system, right? So you know,
what do you mean by that?
Well, in the sense that Epstein, you know, I think it can be tempting in these cases to talk only about the philanthropic issue here, whether we're talking about Jeffrey Epstein or the Sacklers. In both cases,
the Sacklers being Purdue Pharma,
yeah, which has been another story about, you know, sort of what money should nonprofits take and not take. Well, in both cases, the justice system let them off easy with plea agreements in 2008, I think it was, in Epstein's case in Florida, in 2007, in the case of the Sacklers, that allowed them to essentially turn around and continue to commit, in Epstein's case, absolutely heinous crimes. So go ahead.
Well, so I wanted to ask you about that, Phil. So you heard Max Larkin, the WBU reporter, refer to Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig's piece. He's a friend of Joey Ito.
Yep.
And he basically argued in a Medium blog that the only way to take the Epstein money was anonymously, because then you're not conferring legitimacy on Epstein. So in the end, he said he finally came to the conclusion that they still shouldn't have done it. But what about this whole anonymous so we don't confer legitimacy and does that make it okay kind of thing?
I don't buy it. I mean, as I said at the outset, I think a good test in life of whether you're comfortable with doing something is if everybody knew about it, would I feel okay? Would I be embarrassed? I think transparency is important for nonprofits. I mean, there isn't a requirement that you say where every cent came from, but I think it's best practice to do that, and particularly as an academic institution where there are questions, the kind that Justin is alluding to, about, well, you know, what who's behind this work? And are there certain implicit or explicit promises being made or winks and nudges about if we fund this, the outcome will be that? Well, universities, colleges, at their best, are supposed to live outside those kinds of forces. And obviously, they don't always.
Justin, how should organizations, you know, nonprofits like this, utilize corporate money? You've expressed some real concern that that can taint the interaction. So what do you think the right threshold is there?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that I have a great answer. I guess, broadly speaking, if you're seeing the amount of money you bring in to your research budget as a question of prestige for the institution, and as these college rankings keep on pushing institutions to raise more and more from whoever is willing to cut them a check in order to raise their stature, I think about what might happen to the stature of your institution if the something goes really, really south with the donor or the money, and sort of examine what the possible benefit to the donor might be from this conferred association with MIT, what they might hope to gain from it. While Jeffrey Epstein was anonymous, like, he did get something out of it. He was allowed to be a go-between to Bill Gates, to go to him and get him to donate lots of money to MIT. He got to have Joy Ito come to his own private island. Like, Epstein got a lot. What did the Media Lab get? $525,000. That's not a lot of money when compared to their budget. There was no point to take it in the first place, and they did, and that just betokens such bad judgment that I hope that MIT really looks at this closely over the next several months.
Phil, go ahead, jump in. We've got a little bit of time left.
I'd just say that I agree completely, and I think that, you know, leadership, we need to have high expectations for our nonprofit and college and university leaders. And the notion that because the rankings reward fundraising numbers, therefore we must accept all donations is, of course, preposterous. Leadership is about sometimes saying, no, we will not accept this. Even though at some level you would love to have the resources. And this was a failure on that dimension. And I think it's appropriate that people have called it out in the way that they have.
That's Phil Buchanan, president of the Center for Effective Philanthropy. He's also the author of Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. Thanks for being here, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
And we had Justin Peters. He's a Slate columnist and the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of the Free Culture on the Internet. Thanks for being with us, Justin.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Stay with us. Coming up, we will talk about a big weekend in Boston sports. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it was a big weekend in Boston sports. The Patriots started the NFL season with a bang, and Dave Dombrowski is out as head of baseball operations for the Red Sox. Joining us to talk about the news in sports in Boston is Ben Volin, NFL reporter for the Boston Globe. Ben, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me today. Never a dull moment with Boston sports.
No, and let's start with the Patriots.
Funky little snap. Oh boy. And wide, wide. Philip Dorsett, big night for him. Touchdown. 58 yards.
All right, that, of course, was Philip Dorsett scoring one of three touchdowns last night in a 33-3 blowout game against the Pittsburgh Steelers. 33-3 is one heck of a way to start a season. What was your reaction to the big win last night?
It was such a blowout that it almost felt like a fifth preseason game. The Steelers forgot to show up for this game. Such a great night for the Patriots all the way around. To use a pun, it was a banner night. They dropped the banner for the Super Bowl, the latest one, and then The place was just rocking. They did a really electric performance before the game. And then Tom Brady and the Patriots kept it going, and they came out and just looked so dynamic on both sides of the ball. And, you know, then they're adding this unbelievable, talented receiver. So it's just everything's looking up for the Patriots right now.
So it is not always typical for a championship team to kind of come back really strong the next year, as evidenced by the Red Sox's deflating season after winning the World Series last year. But the Pats are not a typical team. So why were they so good last night? What was key to this win? I mean, you said that the other team basically didn't show up, but is that really it, or were we very strong?
The Patriots are, they're looking fantastic on both sides of the ball. There's no question. The offense was supposed to be a work in progress, and the defense is really the backbone. They've returned, I believe, 9 out of 11 starters from the defense that won the Super Bowl and really shut down the Rams. It's a veteran group. We all know the names, Devin McCourty, Dante Hightower, Stephon Gilmore. So it's a very veteran-laden group on defense, and they looked fantastic last night. And then on offense, all of a sudden, you know, we didn't know who Tom Brady's receivers are, but then the last couple weeks they got Edelman back, and they got Josh Gordon back, and Philip Dorsett looks great, and now Antonio Brown's coming in. And so it's like Rob Gronkowski who? You know, you almost forgot that he's gone at this point just because they found so many superstars. And they you know, it was just one game. There are going to be hiccups along the road this year. It's not always going to look this easy. But they look great on both sides of the ball, and how do you not consider them the favorites to get back to the Super Bowl again?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't ever want to, you know, jinx a team. I did have people text me last night, hey, what am I bringing to the Super Bowl party this year? Is it too soon to tell? I mean, this was week one. We're just off the preseason. Are the Pats looking that strong? Do we have Super Bowl hopes?
I mean, obviously Super Bowl hopes. They enter the season on a very short list of teams that's, you know, at the top of the list. And at minimum, they're back in the conference championship game every year. That's just how this team operates in this part of the dynasty right now. And I think absolutely if everything kind of breaks their way with injuries, that the schedule lines up well for them and they're going to be loaded on offense now and their defense looks great. I mean, they just look like a very complete team. But look, injuries happen. It's a long season. It is just week one. By the time we get to December, we won't even remember what happened in this game. And frankly, one area of concern right now is the offensive line, which is a very important part of the team, protecting Tom Brady, creating holes up front. And they have some injuries right now. They lost their center, who's a team captain. He had blood clots in his lungs, so he's out for the year, David Andrews. And last night, we don't know the extent of the injury, but Marcus Cannon, the right tackle, he's out. So that's kind of the one position group other than quarterback you don't want to see injuries. And so that's one thing to monitor moving forward. But, of course, this looks like, you know, they've been to 4 Super Bowls in 5 years, so absolutely, why can't they make it 5 out of 6?
All right, so you've made reference a couple times already to this receiver. The game last night was part of a 1-2 punch from the Patriots this weekend, the other piece being the news that they're going to add arguably the best general wide receiver in football, Antonio Brown, to the mix. It's a 1-year contract. He just quit the Raiders. Can the Pats make him fit into the team? He's a controversial guy.
Absolutely. He's been a very controversial player, and he's never been one. The Patriots ethos of do your job and be reliable, that has never been Antonio Brown. He was a major headache for the Steelers for 9 years. And then he's a major headache for the Raiders complained his way out of town before even suiting up for one game. However, most of the risk in this situation is in Antonio Brown's court. The Patriots don't really need him. He's more of a luxury at this point. They have a lot of other weapons. They definitely got him for, you know, less than market value. The Raiders were going to pay him $15 million this year. The Patriots got him for 10 and some incentives. If he doesn't work out, if he skips meetings, if he's a malcontent, the Patriots will just cut him and move on. It's really, you know, the ball's in Antonio Brown's court, and if he behaves and plays well, he's got Tom Brady throwing him footballs. He could have an unbelievable season playing in big moments on the big stage and could set himself up for a huge contract next year. So really the risk is in his court. So the Patriots did a good job of you know, getting a low-risk, high-reward type of move.
All right. I want to move on to the Red Sox in a second. But before we do, I want to ask you about Pat's owner, Robert Kraft. He was very much a part of the celebration, bringing home the Super Bowl trophy. You know, he carried it onto the field during the pregame last night. This follows his controversy over the misdemeanor charges of soliciting prostitution that he's been dealing with since the spring. Didn't keeping him from attending the NFL, it looked like the NFL was going to keep him from attending. They didn't. Did that surprise you? What do you have to say about that?
I wasn't surprised. That episode is mostly over with at this point, the sense that I've gotten. You know, even though the state is still appealing one of the rulings, Robert Kraft successfully fought a lot of the charges and got a lot of the key evidence thrown out. So once the court case basically fell in his favor, then the NFL found no reason to punish him. They claim to hold owners to an even higher standard than everyone else. And in theory, Roger Goodell, under the personal conduct policy, could be suspending Robert Kraft. But Roger Goodell really does what the 32 owners want to do. And the sense I got from speaking to many of them over the offseason, they didn't want to punish Robert Kraft for this. And having the charges basically dismissed has given them reason not to kind of overlook it. And time has passed, and I think a lot of people have moved on. And it, in reality, it really was a misdemeanor, and there was no human trafficking involved. So I was not surprised to see Robert Kraft involved last night. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, this episode is probably over for him.
All right. So we spoke with Nikki Bell, founder and director of Living and Freedom Together, or LIFT, which supports survivors of commercial sex exploitation and trafficking in Worcester. It doesn't feel like it was over, you know, from her perspective. I started by asking her whether the fact that there would be no human trafficking charges against Kraft changed anything in her mind.
Just because nobody's being charged doesn't mean that there wasn't trafficking involved, right? Trafficking cases are super difficult to actually, like, bring to a conclusion. The victims, you know, are often fearful and not willing to come forward. It, you know, and to me, no, it doesn't make a difference. Because when we're talking about, like, being willing, right, it's the people with the least amount of choices that end up in prostitution. It's typically about survival. We're talking about vulnerable people, right? People that are economically disadvantaged. There's a big race factor that plays into all of this as well, right? They're entering prostitution because they don't have any other choices. So I think it's like a distinction without a difference.
So does this say something about essentially that Robert Kraft's ability to succeed, make money, continue in his profession essentially matters more than the victimization
of the women that he was exploiting? Robert Kraft had the ability to choose to do this, right? So he's got power, wealth, money, privilege, right? He's got all of those things. These women didn't have a choice at the end of the day, right? So these women were living in these places. So they were, like, living in these massage parlors. They were, like, cooking on hot plates in the alley. There was trafficking going on in this massage parlor. There just wasn't a trafficking conviction at the end of it.
So, Nikki, what would you like to see happen going forward, either from the case, the prosecution, or from the NFL?
You know, I mean, I think that's a hard thing for me to determine, right? I think he should suffer some severe economic consequences, right? He has the ability, you know, would I like to see the Patriots take a stand and say, or the NFL take a stand and say, no, like owners of our teams will not be buying vulnerable women for sex? Yes, that is what I would love to see. Do I think that's ever going to happen? No, I don't.
So I want to leave 1 minute on the clock at the end for the Red Sox, but just quickly, you know, the NFL has had a lot of trouble when it comes to women over the last several years. Does it behoove the NFL to take a different approach than it has been on a subject like this?
She wasn't wrong in feeling, you know, disappointed that Robert, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, of course. But, you know, the NFL, they do support women's groups, and they, you know, they make the month of October, you know, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And I realize that people, you know, think there could be, you know, other elements at play there in terms of marketing. But, you know, what more do we want from the NFL? They are an entertainment product. And like I said, she's not wrong for feeling that way. But I think just most of the public, they don't feel that seriously about this misdemeanor charge that he eventually defeated in court because the authorities overstepped their bounds in you know, gathering the evidence. So it's I don't think she was correct with some of those facts about, you know, the women sleeping there and the cooking on the hot plates. I think that was debunked, that these women, I think, were, you know, there really wasn't any shred of evidence of human trafficking. So I'm not sure, you know, what else we want. Robert Kraft already suffered a penalty in the form of public embarrassment. I mean, he was blasted all over the, you know, national news for human trafficking. So I, even though he got off, I still think he suffered in all of this, and we're still talking about it 7 months later, even though he pretty much defeated the charges.
All right, we've got about 30 seconds left. The Sox fired Dave Dombrowski, president of baseball operations, last night after a loss to the Yankees. Are you surprised, and what does it mean for the team?
I wasn't too surprised because this team, no question, has underachieved. They had a controversial spring training with the way they handled coming off the World Series and their pitching staff, and it all kind of blew up. And the expectations here in Boston are championship or bust, and this year was not successful in any stretch. And John Henry, my colleague Dan Shaughnessy, mentioned that Henry said in spring training that they were going to address Dombrowski's contract this year. They never did. They let it go, and I think the time came now that it was time to move on and start a new era for the Red Sox.
All right, that's Ben Volen, NFL reporter for the Boston Globe. Ben, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. We're a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.